Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Ready to relax in your dream bath retreat without the stress of figuring out every detail yourself? At the Home Depot, your bath upgrade is covered. Shop fully designed rooms and curated bath collections to go from inspiration to transformation fast. Savings of up to 40% will make it easier on your budget. And find everything you need, from tubs to toilets and all the tile in between, to bring your vision to life. The Home Depot. Dream baths built here.
Ugh, you said you were over him, but his hoodie is still in your rotation. It's time. Grab your phone, snap a few pics, and sell it on Depop. Listed in minutes, with no selling fees. And just like that, a guy 500 miles away just paid full price for your closure. And right on cue.
Hey, still got my hoodie?
Nope, but I've got tonight's dinner paid for. Start selling on Depop, where taste recognizes taste. List now with no selling fees. Payment processing fees and boosting fees still apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the Migration Podcast, your guide for waterfowl hunting tactics, gear, and conservation. And now, your host, Brian Hallblyde.
What is up, everyone? As Johnny M said, I'm your host, Brian Hallblyde. I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to tune in to the Migration Waterfowl Podcast. Thank you so much. This episode is brought to you by Bluebird Waterfowl, creator of The Animator. The Animator is revolutionizing the waterfowl community with the world's first spinning wing decoy conversion kit. Turn your existing spinner into a water motion decoy in seconds and learn how to finish more birds with the sound of water. Guaranteed to boost your hunt or your money back. Flaring birds with your spinner is a thing of the past. Try one risk-free at bluebirdwaterfowl.com or at your favorite local outdoor supplier. This episode is also brought to you by the Duck Hole & Company, attracting feathers together. They are a full-service habitat company located in North Carolina. If you have questions about waterfowl habitat or need some work done on your property, contact them through any of their social media platforms at The Duck Hole Company. They can also fix you up with golden millet, also known as the duck buffet and the best bang for your duck. This episode is also brought to you by CK Custom Calls, custom built in the USA from the great state of Texas. Handmade in a world of mass produced. Check out their calls on their Instagram and Facebook pages at CK Custom Calls. They showcase calls for sale there, and you can also contact them for a custom order. Be sure to let them know you heard about them on the Migration Waterfowl Podcast. Thank you to all of you who have been supporting our sponsors. It really helps the show out when you do that, and I greatly appreciate it. Also, check out our Migration Waterfowl store if you want a shirt, hoodie, insulated drink bottle, coffee, and more. We've got a new election t-shirt featuring two of our favorite candidates for 2024, Mallard and Pintail, available in 8 colors and only $25. Let's help out their campaign with 10% of every sale going to Ducks Unlimited. You can find a link to our Migration Waterfowl store in our Instagram and Facebook pages. There are also some free ways that you can help support me. You can tell your waterfowl hunting family and friends about us that maybe haven't heard of us. That's one of the best ways you can help us grow. You can also take a minute and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. If you send me a message after you leave the review, I'll send you a Migration Waterfowl podcast decal. Be sure to check out Migration Mondays on our YouTube channel. Those episodes are our video companion to this audio podcast. This week, I share a video clip from our episode with Thomas from Hoke Outdoors about hunting out of state and what goes into his preparations for those trips. Be sure to subscribe to the channel so you don't miss the latest uploads. Also, I'll be recording all of my scouting and hunting this summer and fall and posting those videos to the YouTube channel. I got my youngest daughter moved into her college apartment with no issues. Everything went pretty smooth there. She's going to be starting class in about 3 weeks, so she'll be bouncing back and forth between home and her apartment. Until then, helping them get everything set up the way they want. So I'll get to spend some more time with her before school starts. And it's been a lot of fun having her and my oldest home most of the summer. As you know, my oldest started medical school, so she went back a few weeks ago. But always nice to have some extra time to catch up with them and see the cool stuff that God's doing in their lives. We got another fun date night in with my wife on Saturday evening. We went to a local mini golf spot not far from us. We usually get a few trips there every summer, but the family schedule has been kind of crazy this summer. So that was actually our first time there. We're certainly going to miss the girls when they're back to school, but that also means more time for us and more date nights. So make sure you guys and girls that are in relationships out there are making time for that. No matter how long you've been together, always try to keep dating each other. It's pretty important. And a lot of successful marriages that I watched growing up and that I see now, people are always making time to do that, to keep that going in your relationship. If you want to keep things fresh and going in the right direction. So yeah, after 26 years of marriage, we still make time and enjoy doing things together. And it's nice to get that time in before the grind of the hunting season begins. So make sure you're prioritizing that. Finally talked with the transmission shop earlier today, and my truck should be ready to go tomorrow. So by the time this episode launches, I should have my truck back. I'm looking forward to making a few scouting trips at the end of this week, since I've gotten a little behind on those preparations. I've got several Onyx pins to check out in Western Pennsylvania, and I marked a bunch in Eastern Ohio also. See if I can find some teal over there for that early season that they offer. I'm also getting down to being about a month away from hitting the road for teal season out in Nebraska and Kansas. So I'm glad I got the air conditioning sorted out. Transmission's going to be taken care of. Fingers crossed, we don't have any other major issues for a while, so I can get busy getting the truck set up for hunting season and mobile camping. As I discussed a couple of times before, I've got a soft cap that goes on the back of my pickup, and I have a pretty extensive, comfortable camping setup that I run in the back of that during hunting season. So I'll be bringing that to YouTube. Once I get that all put back together, I'll do a walk around video and show you guys kind of what that looks like and some of the stuff that I use. So I also got a big order of golden millet seed in the mail from our partner over at the Duck Hole and Company the other day. I'm looking forward to getting it planted on some of my private and permission pieces. This millet heads out in about 60 days, so I've got plenty of time, and I'll probably be staggering plantings around over the next 2 months, and it's going to be fun to see how the ducks relate to it over the upcoming season. On today's episode, I'm going to be talking with Ramsey Russell, owner of GetDucks.com and host of the Duck Season Somewhere podcast. Ramsey grew up in Mississippi and had a grandfather who told him stories about duck hunting in the Mississippi Delta. He would tag along on some dove hunts, but it wasn't until after high school that Ramsey became a duck hunter himself. We discuss his education in wildlife biology, his pursuit of a career in whitetail deer management, and his first job on a low-fence trophy deer property in South Texas near the Mexican border. We talk about his move from private forestry and wildlife management to his positions with the state and federal government, and ultimately becoming a hunting booking agent. We discuss how his disappointing first out-of-state waterfowl hunt turned into a career that spanned around the world and over several decades. We get into hunting ducks in Mexico, Argentina, and beyond. And we also get to hear some of his favorite hunting experiences and stories. I really enjoyed talking with Ramsey and getting to know him better. Just want to say thanks to the Lord for giving us all this opportunity to be together for another episode. So let's get into episode number 15. Welcome back to another episode of the Migration Waterfowl Podcast. I sure appreciate you all coming back and joining me today. Got a special guest today, Mr. Ramsey Russell. How are you today, my friend?
Brian, I'm good. Thanks for having me, man. It's raining down here in Mississippi, but it's a little bit of break in the stifling heat. Finally glad to be home after 10 weeks in Argentina, and very proud to be on y'all's podcast.
I appreciate you coming on, and definitely want to get into that hunt for sure. It sounded super interesting. But in case there's been any of our listeners that have been living under rocks that haven't heard of you, can you mind introducing yourself, telling us where you're from, what you do for a living, anything else
you want
to share?
Well, my name is Ramsey Russell. I'm officially old geezer age. I've been around, it seems like, since forever. My background is forestry and wildlife. I left a federal government career midway to retirement to pursue becoming a hunting consultant, specializing in waterfowl worldwide, doing business under the name brand for 22 years, GetDucks.com.
Yeah, that's super interesting. How did you get started in the outdoor space? You've been waterfowl hunting most of your life?
Well, I grew up in Mississippi, in the Mississippi Delta, with a grandfather that was a duck hunter. He was a dove hunter, not like we think of it today. That generation, or his generation, or his group of folks, they didn't pursue it every waking moment. That was something they did on the weekends or something they did for leisure and recreation. But nonetheless, he thought enough to introduce me to a hot, dusty dove field when I was a child. And I guess that was my beginnings of the shotgun sports. I really did not get into duck hunting until after high school. And by then, he was gone. He had aged out. I never did duck hunt with him. but I remembered the stories and found myself duck hunting here, there, and yonder. Honestly, mostly wood duck type stuff in beaver ponds. Sometimes after dark, I guess. I later learned the difference, but I actually went to Mississippi State University wanting to be a white-tailed deer biologist. I wanted to be a Dr. Deer. Man, that was what I wanted to do, is what led me into the university, which, boy, I had to start at scratch to catch up with my studies after not paying attention during high school all those years. And I got a job down on the Mexican border in South Texas on an amazing, generationally owned, low-fence, trophy-managed white-tailed deer property, and where antlerless deer management and food plots and all kinds of stuff and growing big trophy bucks for a handful of clients was kind of the job description. I learned a lot about white-tailed deer and nutrition and habitat and age structure and all that good stuff I went to do, but a funny thing happened. We were shooting so many antlerless deer, it was like a job description. Mm-hmm. And 30 miles behind a locked gate, and every time we dropped a disc to plant food plots, here would come the morning doves. It just happened to hit that time on the ranch that it was the fifth consecutive growing season rain, so there were the Bob White and scaled quail were having two or three clutches there. It was just like walking through the land of plenty on that ranch, and that's how I began to you know, entertain myself in between working, which was real ranch work, but at the same time and after hours was doing antlerless deer management, and too much of a good thing almost at that point. And one day I went out, I noticed later in November the wind started blowing from the north, and a lot of the stock tanks on this ranch were covered with ducks, and I went out and shot ducks, and it was really kind of sort of my introduction. I never would have dreamed at that point, with what I wanted to do and where I wanted to be in life and where I thought I was going, that it would turn into what it did. I ended up graduating Mississippi State University with an undergraduate degree in wildlife management, which in the Deep South is habitat management, aka forest management. Got a master's degree in bottomland hardwood silviculture, and landed a job with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service managing a lot of refuges up in the northern part of Mississippi and associated properties, doing a lot of tree planting, doing a lot of forest management, things of that nature. Shifted over into USDA and got real bored doing administrative type stuff in 24 Mississippi counties. I handled all the forestry concerns for the Farm Bill program. And I had continued on duck hunting, had duck hunted and duck hunted and duck hunted, and went on a really, really, really bad trip right after grad school. I went to Canada. I booked a trip with the Foremost Outfitter of the time, and it was a disaster. It started off with a highly inebriated Native American picking us up at hour and a half past daylight, and went downhill from there. And that was a lot of money, fresh out of college to have blown. And I started doing my own research. I found a guy. I brought a few buddies with me. We had a great time up in Alberta. And about the third season, I went up there and hunted with him. He come by my room, knocked on the door, and invited me out to the garage for a beer in front of his staff or with his staff, and said, "I'd like you to be my booking agent." And I said, "What the hell is a booking agent? I'm a forester with the U.S. Department of Agriculture." And he explained the way it worked. And so I said, "Well, I can probably find a few hunters." I was prowling around the chat rooms, and I knew some other duck hunters and stuff like that. But I knew I had to have one of these newfangled things called a web page. And that's kind of how it started. Humbly enough, GetDucks.com began back around 2002 or 2003 with one hunt, Alberta, and doing habitat consulting. And never in a million years would I have dreamed that it was going to take me on the life course and life path that it since has.
Yeah, that's quite a story, jumping around from organization to organization. But backing up a little bit, what kind of pushed you to book that trip in Canada? Or you just kind of want to stretch your legs from Mississippi, or what was your process?
I did. You know, when I was in college, somewhere along the way, I think maybe for Christmas, one of the relatives had given me a book about wing shooting around the world. It was kind of a coffee table book. And it opened up my horizons. I mean, it, here I was hunting in Mississippi, wood ducks, mallards and whatnot, you know, and got to seeing all these birds and reading about rosy-billed poachers and yellow-billed ducks in Africa and rosy-billed poachers down in Argentina, and seeing all these experiences and going, wow, the world really is a lot bigger than my backyard. In grad school, I taught my girlfriend, now my wife for 30 years next week, into coming with me down to Texas. And I went on a snow goose hunt back in the day that Texas had a vibrant snow goose population. A lot of rice was still in place down in Texas. And I went on this hunt, and it was just, it began there. So by the time I'd gotten into college, you know what I wanted to shoot throughout high school and college, or college primarily, we shot migratory, we shot resident Canadas. We're out there duck hunting, and we'd shoot Canada geese, but we all knew that the Canada goose migration had ceased back in the 60s when my grandfather's generation hunted them. And I wanted to shoot I wanted to shoot real Canada geese like you read about and heard about. I wanted to go somewhere they had real Canada geese, and hey, maybe I could shoot more snow geese too. And that's what led me to Canada was, and really, you know what I wanted to shoot? And it's so funny looking back. I wanted to shoot those great big B-52 migrator giants. I wanted to shoot them little bitty ones, those little Canadas, the littles in the middles, I call them now, the cacklers. I'd never seen anything like that in the state of Mississippi.
Hmm. So that must have been quite a pivot going from government work with the USDA to becoming a private.
It wasn't. It wasn't instantaneous. We're talking about a nearly 2-decade time frame. I mean, man, I had the training, I had the background. All I wanted to do when I went to Mississippi State University, it was a monumental hurdle for me to get that kind of technical education. I had to really apply myself for the first time in my life, and I wanted it though. But you know, really and truly, simply enough, humbly enough, I just wanted to work for the federal government, work out in nature, and make the world a better place. And that's really what compelled me. And long story short, I realized working in a bureaucracy and a system like that really wasn't best suited to my personality. That's the simple and polite way of putting it. I just wasn't cut out. I've always said, you know, you can tell me what to do or how to do it, but you can't tell me both. And And really and truly, even when I started that little web page and was booking those Alberta hunts and doing a little consulting on the side, I thought I was going to retire with the federal government. I mean, just it was a nice, comfortable job, and wasn't too terribly stressful. But maybe that was it. Maybe my personality is geared for just a little more chaos, a little more push, a little more drive. I think that's what pushes me along. And I can remember selling a few hunts here and there, you know, back in the day, and it was all fine. And the phones began to ring just a little bit more and a little bit more. And I was doing a lot of consulting, doing a lot of baseline management plans for conservation easements. It was a lucrative business that ceased when Obama came into office. That program just kind of disappeared. But it was lucrative. It was something I could do in a part-time. It kept me busy. It was right in my technical wheelhouse. And I was still kind of scaling out and doing some stuff with this Get Ducks deal. And part-time, though it was. Excuse me. And I can remember... my wife kind of started taking over a few of the books, and she recruited my father-in-law, who was an accountant, to come set up a little more formal structure. And I can remember him calling me to his office one day and saying, "I thought you were just duck hunting and fooling around. I didn't know this was real." And he said, "I know you're not making any money right now. I know you're not making a living. I know you can't leave the federal government. He retired with the U.S. federal government years before. And he said, "I can't believe I'm telling the father of my grandkids this, but Ramsey, this is something you should take a little more seriously and might be start to think long term and begin to plan an exit from the federal government at some point in time in the future. Because at some point in time in the future, this is going to become busy enough that you can't do both. You're going to hit a crossroads. And I thought, sitting at the table, I knew what he was talking about. And it was some years later, a couple of years later maybe, that it hit that crossroads. I was out of time. I had exhausted, under new leadership, I had exhausted all of my leave, pretty much. And going out and scouting and doing what we were doing and putting this thing together. And I had to just do a lot of soul searching and ask myself, do I want the comfort of working with the federal government, continuing on this course that I started, or like coming to a fork in the road, do I want to take it? Am I ready to jump off in the dark and work for myself? And it was a very daunting process. That was very, you know, as a father with three young children and a wife and a mortgage and everything else, it was scary. But you know, I later talked to my brother-in-law, and we were looking at some numbers and looking at some books, and he asked me, he said, what compelled you to do this? And I told him, I said, I just felt it. I felt like it was a good move, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I laid out my case, and he bust out laughing, and he said, that's why you're an entrepreneur. You know, and that's just what it took. It took taking this leap of faith, because even though that was a long time ago, there was enough feedback and enough stuff going, I began to gain a real sense of understanding. There's a lot of young people out there. There's a lot of brands that have come and gone trying to get into this space. And I started the same way they did. I'm just going to sell a hunt, go to Canada every now and again, and run this thing part-time. But Brian, you know, the truth of the matter is, if you're writing a check to somebody for a service and you're getting no more than their part-time attention, you're writing a check to the wrong guy.
That's a fact.
That's kind of sort of the same thing that happened to me when I booked that first fateful trip that went off the rails. And I began to gain a sense of how a lot of people in this space were not really doing it the way I would wish that somebody had done it for me or would do it for me. And making themselves personally available, making sure the details are taken care of. It became a very complex and detailed type situation. Brian, do you know what the greatest limitation is? It's not money. Money is not the limiting factor. Time is the limiting factor.
Absolutely.
And when you're in the service industry, and I don't care what service industry it is, you may be substituting experience for theirs, lack thereof, or something like that, but at the same time, you are spending your time in lieu of theirs to put everything into place. And that's kind of sort of what happened. I had gone to a few small shows locally, you know, get the name out, talk to all my buddies and my friends and shake new hands in my local communities. And I finally met a local guy that truly was one of those, without intending to be, he really turned into be a big influence in my life just for this very reason. He took a little interest in me. He was a world traveler, a world hunter, a very renowned personality in his circles. And he said, how come you're not at Dallas Safari Club? Never heard of it. And it took me a while to get in. I had to call a favor, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I finally got in one year to this show. And once you're in, you're in. And that's when my world changed. I had taken a week off from work, gone to this big convention. And for 4 days of nonstop traffic coming to my booth, forgotten all about federal government employment. Hmm. And when I came home, long story short, I walked in that office, looked around and said, you know, I think I found my calling in life and it ain't this. And that was when, you know, within a year I had resigned my position and committed myself to this full time. But now get this, I went from a 40-hour a week federal government job to 120 more hours working for myself.
For sure.
And I found out that was better for me. That, you know, mm-hmm. like I can remember back in college, I'd have every now and again, just the way the schedules failed and everything else, I might have a slow semester with 15 to 18 hours. to include lab work, but I mean, in a big long week, it really ain't much. It was those semesters that it tipped the other way, that I had to work 21, 22 hours and keep up all those studies and all the reports. That was when that's when I emerged. That was what brought up my best. I didn't have time to goof off.
Right.
I had to focus, and that's what brought out my personal best. So I feel like it was one of those things meant to be. I never set out and planned it, but in hindsight, 2020, it worked out that way. You know what I'm saying? It's just all sure. The little stars lined up, and I came into it.
Yeah, but you took the chance. You took the leap of faith. A lot of people get to that edge a lot, but they kind of stay in their comfort zone. And I'm always fascinated by a lot of the successful people that I talk to and meet and discuss things along the way. It's a similar story. You know, they're taking that chance. A lot of people aren't willing to step off that cliff.
I would tell anybody that walks to the edge of that cliff, jump. Do it. No matter what you're thinking, I promise you. And here's why. Because most people that are willing to jump off that cliff, they've got something deep inside them that they're going to scrap and they're going to fight. Think of it like this. You don't know how to swim. Most people get thrown off a boat into the water. By God, they're going to swim.
Yeah,
they're going to figure out how to keep your head above water. And it brings out your best. You know, but I don't think that. But I've got a sordid past. I've talked about in the past. I mean, I'm a burn victim. I was involved in a home explosion. I did literally die the mm-hmm. night they brought me into the ER. I had an 8% probability for survival, 92% probability of mortality. 6 months later, I emerged on the other side of burn center and had a long road to hoe coming at it. But it's just who I am, that fighting, that survival mode. You know what I'm saying? And I don't think
Absolutely.
I'm unique. I don't think I'm special. I think that everybody has that deep down inside them if they'll just let it be. You know what I'm
For
saying?
Sure.
We're all programmed that way.
Yeah, absolutely. So you get to this point and you start expanding. Or do you have to go out and kind of find – you know, the best places after your bad experience in Canada? Obviously, you want to try to avoid that at all costs for your customers. So kind of walk us through that journey of, you know, trying to figure out and going and visiting, figuring out who the best outfitters are and where
yeah,
the best
well,
places to send your
first
customers.
Off, Brian, you're right. You know, I did, but I didn't know where to start or how to start. I mean, somebody invited me to Argentina. I went to Argentina. They proposed a little deal. I'm going to work with them. I'm going to do this. That was a shit show of epic proportion, and both the outfitter and the person that invited me to jump on this scam he had going, it just wasn't what it's supposed to be. And but understand now, I've got a young family, I've got the bills everybody's got, I've mm-hmm. got a 40-hour week job, so I couldn't just go. I couldn't just pack my suitcase, say see you in a year. You know, didn't have the time or the money to do that kind of stuff. So it took time. It took time to put it together. It took a trip down to Argentina. It took another trip down to Uruguay. It took more trips down there, just a little at a time, a little at a time. And and leading to the part I exhausted all my government time, I ended up working with a lodge down there. It was good. It was fun. It was great. They're still around. They're a beautiful setup. But it wasn't my cup of tea. It wasn't. And I would take clients down there that just, they loved it, they had a great time, they wouldn't go back. And one time I met some clients, we were having drinks on the patio of their camp house, and I would ask them why they wouldn't go back. And they shrugged it off and said, you know, find us a real duck hunt, Ramsey. Find mm-hmm. us one like right here. And so I would go and I would scout and I would look and I would make phone calls or you know, just network like you do, and that's back before social media too terribly easy. But I would network and go here and go there, and over time, it's easy. It's hard to talk about what I was doing 5 years into it as much as talking 22 years in retrospect. You know, it was just any hunt down in Argentina. Well, I shouldn't say that. I talked to a guy today that went on a hunt you don't ever want to go on. But most hunts down in Argentina, your average mediocre hunts down in Argentina are way better than anything you're going to experience in the United States.
Really?
They've got more liberal limits. They've got more abundance of birds. They can practice different things that we can't do here. They don't have a Migratory Bird Treaty Act. And so, you know, by comparison, it's going to be good. But as you start branching out and looking around, you know, your basis of comparison is not to Mississippi or Pennsylvania. It's to the last 30 outfitters or 50 outfitters or 150 outfitters that you visited.
Okay.
And, you know, and then I began, you know, and understand I am a duck hunter. I'm an avid duck hunter. That first trip up to Canada, I had shot a few species of birds. I'm going to say I'd shot maybe 15 or 20 waterfowl species in North America. There are 50-something to include subspecies. I've now bagged nearly all of them. I've killed 127 species and subspecies worldwide. My world began to expand. You know, so man, I got in bloodhound mode. Oh, I need to find this species or that species. Well, look over here in Australia, or look over here in New Zealand, or what about over there in Eurasia? You know, I began to expand. I began to grow and evolve. At the time, I'd have told you I was a species collector. And it sounds like, oh, Ramsey's a species collector, but I'm not a species collector. I'm an experience collector. And again, with time and experience, was I able to look back and say, I'm really not chasing species. It's where on a map, where on earth those species take me. That's unique, that experience. That's what I'm into, that whole process. And that's just, at some point in time, it got such that the hunts find us now, Brian. I mean, they are we're out there enough in those circles that a lot of those outfitters, like there are three unique locations we're looking at right now on a map, and we're way back in the bushes on it. We've been reached out to, and we've gone back and forth with some emails, and just giving them a list of things we need regarding legalities and exports and guns and species and limits and just all the back end type stuff that goes into it. But so we're always looking. We're still looking, but it kind of hit a balance to where I'm gonna take Argentina because that is one of my favorite destinations. I love it. I love the people. I love the culture. I love its history. I love the habitat. I love the abundance of ducks. I just like it. You know what I'm saying? If I could only go to one foreign destination anymore, it'd be Argentina. I like it. I like my version of Argentina, I should say. And you know, it's gotten to a point now, it is a tad contentious on the showroom floor. A lot of the Argentine outfitters we don't represent hate our guts. And I got to say, the feeling's a tad mutual. You know what you run into, Brad, in this industry? When I think of a lot of the duck guides and duck outfitters that I was familiar with then, back in those days, I revered guides and outfitters as experts.
Yeah.
You know, like from the outside looking in way back when, I envisioned that these people were experts that led them into something.
Sure.
Kind of like Ramsey got led 22 years into Get Ducks. It was built on expertise and experience and superiority. Hate to tell anybody listening, that ain't the case, man. Anybody right. can be a guide and outfitter. And when you get outside the United States, it's magnified to where a lot of your top flight, a lot of you guys that have been online looking around at Argentina or even Mexico or, God forbid, some of these other third world countries, a lot of the big blue chip outfitters I'm aware of in Argentina are not hunters themselves at all.
Right.
They are drivers. They are translators. They are some kind of service industry that was exposed at some point in time in the past to all these, quote, rich clients, unquote, from the land of milk and honey coming in and blowing money to shoot a duck or a dove or a perdiz or catch a fish. And they saw an opportunity. And, boy, I tell you what, you could write a book on hunting around the world if you get too far off in that too far off into that part of it to where there's really not a lot of professional difference in hunting and fishing in other parts of the world outside the United States than narcotics or hustling oranges on a street corner. Just this cash business.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And I've seen that kind of stuff. And, you know, I've been on those kind of hunts. And, you know, just scouting them. If I'm going to go down to Argentina, I learned if I'm going to buy a plane ticket, I didn't have a lot of money at that time of my life. But if and even today, if I'm going to go to Argentina or go to this country or that country, if I'm going to travel, my plane ticket stays the same, whether I stay there for 10 weeks or 1 week. So I'll go down and thread it all together to where I'm making a pass, going and visiting my outfitter, maybe going and taking in some new outfitters, going and making some new acquaintances or seeing what else is out there. I'm always turning over rocks, looking for the next great thing. Treasure hunting, you know, I think of it as. And there's nothing that, to anybody listening to your podcast or mine, I'm going to tell you right now, there are no duck hunters on earth that rival American duck hunters. Mm. We have elevated every aspect of this to art form. We're killing more ducks in North America than the rest of the world combined. Yeah. It ain't easy. You know what I'm saying? There's a lot of competition. There's a limited landscape. It takes a skill set. And, you know, from our decoys to our firearms to our shotgun shells, our camo, our motors, our approach, everything is at an elevated level compared to the rest of the world. And if you take a real duck hunter, there is no greater disappointment on earth than going somewhere and realizing these guys ain't hunters.
Sure.
They're just taking me on a song and pony and charging me an arm and a leg. Okay, great. You went out there and shot 15 or 20 ducks a morning. That's nothing.
Right.
That's nothing. Trust me, if that's your experience, I got a phone call. I was down in Argentina this year, got a phone call from a guy that I don't even know how he found a hunt like this. He went on a real shyster type hunt last year. The guy is one of those guys that I just ignore him when he calls. I know his reputation precedes him. This guy ended up in that lodge last year getting, I think he told me the guy was trying to shake him down for thousands of dollars extra.
Mm.
That happens all the time.
Sure.
And Ed, this year he went again. Somebody on that staff had quit that shyster, started his own outfit, got in touch with this guy who booked. I'm sure he paid rock bottom prices. But let me tell you something: when you're just in a truck and you're looking up at a bridge going into a major city in a province in Argentina, shooting a half dozen ducks, you're in trouble. That's when he called me, and I just had nothing I could do to help him. I'm like, man, I just say you shrug off, get what you pay for, and hope for the best, or go home early, which is just right. Gonna cost you money, but you're there, so ride it out. And I followed up with him later that week, and they had just hop, skipped around, jumped, probably trespassed, knowing some of the stories I've heard about the former outfitter he'd hunted with and some other stuff like that on the way back home. They got stopped by the police. And here's a gringo that don't speak Spanish having to hand over, fork over $1,000 to a policeman. And then a little bit down the road, they got stopped again. And I told him, I said, you do realize this shyster you're hunting with is in on this, right? You do understand what's going on, don't you?
Mm.
I mean, so you see that kind of stuff, you know? And I've been, I don't know, wary enough, worldly enough to have bobbed and weaved around that kind of stuff, but you need to know
that
stuff exists. Hell, it exists right here in the United States.
Yeah.
You hear these stories all the time in social media that there are people out there scamming and doing kind of stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
That's a lot of money you're giving over to people. And I think, you know, isn't it, you know what never ceases to amaze me, Brian, is a lot of my industry, a lot of the hunt consultants from back pre-internet are gone. Because during the internet age, same as the news medias or a lot of other analog formats, they're gone.
Yeah.
Because you got this internet. Anybody can find anything on the internet. The downside of that is anybody can be anything on the internet.
Exactly.
The internet didn't change business. It just changed the way you do business. You no longer have some big top secret. you're having to do more. You're having to deliver a superior service. You're having to bring value beyond buy hunt. You're having to bring value to that consumer, make his travel better, the hunt, You know, so you're having to bring value to that hunter. It's a service industry, and that's what I think. I think that's why there was a change of guard from the old guard to the new guard. Is the new guard is operating in the age of internet, where anybody can find anything, but anybody can be anything, has to bring value to the outfitter.
Sure.
And to the consumer.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, having somebody like you that's been down there, that's experienced it, that's kind of navigated your way, it's super important to find people like you to help avoid those pitfalls.
I think it is. It's very important. Which is to say this, Brian, I mean, we're good. We're not God. For the first time,
right.
for the second time in 22 years, for the first time in 15 years, we encountered ice down in Argentina this year. It went from, can you believe, week 1, 2, and 3 were above average warm down in Argentina. I'm talking hot, 80 degrees. To the very next week, a cold front started blowing out of the south, and we were walking on ice one morning. I mean, anything can happen. You know, somebody sent me a text the other morning, some kind of internet glitch, some kind of online glitch or something. Clients got stranded everywhere.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Clients trying to get out, clients trying to get home, airlines weren't flying. I mean, and all we can do is just be there to help navigate through the system, get them back on track, be sure that when they do land, we got somebody waiting to pick them up, get them sure. back on track and line. You know, the great thing I love about duck hunting is you never really, it's like a box of chocolates to go to Forrest Gump. You're never going to know what you get. And that's what makes it so great.
For
you know what I'm saying? But it is real duck hunts for real duck hunters. That's really kind of our hallmark. Is real duck hunts for real duck hunters. Those are the experiences we're chasing. There should be no surprises. Now, if you've never been to Argentina, surprise, the ducks don't look like ours. Surprise, the food's not exactly like ours, but it's great. Mm-hmm. But there shouldn't be any wrinkles. There shouldn't be any misunderstanding on gratuities or gun fees or import or export or pickup times or delivery times or getting you back to the airport. No surprises. That's what we specialize in.
Yeah, so let's say a guy's kind of reached all his goals in North America, and he kind of comes to you and says, "Ramsey, I want to broaden my horizons here." Do you kind of ask them some questions on what they're interested in, or kind of walk us through that process on how
you
try
to
steer them to a certain spot?
Let me ask this question. To start like this, getducks.com, 22 years. I've typed every single word on there myself. And if you go to a lot of other similar web pages, ask yourself, why don't they post the prices?
Right.
Why don't they post the rates? Why don't they post detailed bullet point item, everything not included, everything included? Big red flag if you ever go to a website, don't see it. So, and we were actually questioned by some of our peers and associates years ago about why we were putting so much information on the web page. You know, cause, hey, maybe I could bait them a little bit and they'd come in. That's kind of too much like used car sales.
Sure.
My strategy, coming from my personal standpoint, is I don't want to be sold to. I can make my own decisions. I just need the information. I'm gonna go buy a pair of Western boots. I used to sell Western boots when I was a young man. I'm gonna walk into a boot store. I don't need you standing over my shoulder.
Right.
I just need to look. I need to touch. I need to read the labels. I need to try them on. Then I need to ask you questions, so I can make an informed decision. And what we've tried to do is put all of the information pertinent to these hunts online. You know, just that you, somebody we haven't met yet that's reading from the comfort of their recliner, can make an informed decision. So to your question, Brian, a lot of times, especially 22 years or so into it, 23 years, my wife saying, a lot of people will call up and say, hey, I'm online. I need to go to Argentina. I want to shoot these species. I think this is the hunt I want to go to. Or they'll call up and say, I want to go to Mongolia. Or I want to go to Azerbaijan. Or I want to go somewhere crazy. And then sometimes there are the people that they're done with their 48 or their 50 or whatever they're counting here in the United States, and they want to expand their species list, and the world is full of them. And they'll call us up, and we'll just have long conversations and try to develop a strategy or a program or a priority list for them. Where do you want to go? What do you think you want to do? A lot of our hunts, Brian, you know, Argentina, Mexico, places like that are just mainstream type products throughout our U.S. hunt list in the United States and Canada. They're mainstream all the time, an abundance of bed nights. Some of the hunts we specialize in, such as Azerbaijan, such as Mongolia, Australia, those are very unique hunts that there may only be one date a year available. Mm. I've got some guys wanting to go to Azerbaijan. Well, Azerbaijan sold out for the upcoming year. Because it's just one or two groups a year. And so we're already looking at 2026. You know, Mongolia, same thing. It's a very elite, almost do-it-yourself collector's trip for crown jewel-type species that are found nowhere else on Earth but importable to the United States. And one team a year. You know, one team a year. So that's kind of how we go through the process is sometimes I'll get an email from somebody, a very specific email, and as I read it, they say, well, I want to go over here and do this, but as they're explaining why they want to do it, I realize that's not where they want to go. So I'll call them, and we'll talk through it. And I'll, you know, this is, okay, you say you want to go here, this is what we've got over here, this is why this is great, but have you considered this one? Well, I didn't look at that one. You see what I'm saying? And so it's not about what I want them to do. It's about what they want to do. I mean, half the challenge in having satisfied clients is perfectly reconcile their expectations with reality. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And that's right. that's a lot of what we do. Yeah. It's talk through it and stuff like that. To anybody listening, species collectors and things of that nature. You know, there's really not a lot of hunts that you can be a one-and-done kind of guy. Go to, I'm going to pick on South Africa for a minute. You know, we've got this great hunt in South Africa. It's an amazing trip. We either do five-day or 11-day packages. Some of the guys that go just want to wing shoot. Some of the guys that go want to get down the bush and collect a lot of species. There's about 15 waterfowl species total. Guaranteed you ain't going to collect them all in one trip. Mm. That ain't going to happen. You know what I'm saying? And that'd be like trying to come to America and let's say you're going to start in Massachusetts this summer and make your way to California and try to kill 48 species. I guess you could, but chances are you ain't. Right. You know what the great thing about it is, Brian, is there's worse consolations than having to go back.
Oh, yeah.
It's just worse consolations. And the guys that are those true collectors, they understand that and they accept that.
So let's get into your latest trip down there. I want to hear about how long you were there and kind of the experience you had this time around.
It's kind of gotten out of hand, to be honest with you, Brian. We do a lot of hosted hunts. We still scout. We still look. We put together social media podcasts. This year we hosted Mojo Television on some spots. So I thread my calendar together every year. And the hosted hunts is kind of like this. Depending on the lodge you go to, it's going to take 4 to 10 clients to open the doors. And there are people, but very few of people that I talk to on a day-to-day basis that's got 3 to 10 buddies willing and able to go. Right. These are not inexpensive trips. They're not inexpensive. And so what we're able to do is we put together hosted hunts every year. Brian decides he wants to go to Argentina. He wants to go to this particular lodge. He wants to shoot duck, dove, pigeons, perdiz, maybe go golden dorado fishing at La Paz. Or he wants to go to the remote Paraná hunt in the middle of nowhere, but it's just Brian. I can't open the lodge for just Brian.
Sure.
And even though 99% of the time I could send Brian down there with three or four other guys and them get along just perfectly because birds of a feather flock together, chances are they don't. And what we've seen is if I'll put what I call my spares and pairs together into a team, Brian doesn't know the other guys. The other guys don't know Brian, but everybody knows Ramsey. And we go down, we form a game plan, and we just have a good time. And so So that's kind of how I put together my year. Normally when I go down, I've got some hosted trips I need to attend to. I line them up back to back. I lay out my calendar, and for the past 5 years, it's worked out to about 6 to 10 weeks down in Argentina making the rounds. I'm always, if I catch a week, I'm going to go meet a new outfitter. I'm going to go revisit my existing outfitters. I'm going to keep my hand on the pulse. And I like to duck hunt. I like to take social media. I like to see the stories and all that good stuff. And so I end up spending, I flew down to Argentina this year on May 4th. And I got back home a week ago today, July 15th or somewhere in that time frame. Mm. It was a long 10-week haul. And I always wonder about 8 weeks into it. I know I'm just 2 weeks away. And I'm in the groove. I'm in the zone then, son. I've got my routine down. I'm either transferring or hunting on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Sometimes Saturday morning. Some of the hunts, you know, start on Monday afternoon, end on Saturday morning, or they start Monday morning, end Friday evening. Transfer back to town Saturday, Sundays, boom, redo it again. I take a little Airbnb type apartment in downtown Buenos Aires in Recoleta. I've been staying there 15 years. It's dirt cheap. I don't know of a single hotel in America. Outside of a few I might not want to stay in that are as cheap, and I can walk out the front door. I'm 8 blocks from a park. I take Char Dog with me, and bless her heart, that dog, unlike all the other dogs in Buenos Aires, she's just not going to do her business on concrete. I have walked myself to death trying to get her to give it up on the sidewalk and she ain't going to do it. So I have to walk twice a day. I walk 8 to 10 blocks down to the park and let her air. And just, you know, it's fun. I'm not a city guy at all, but I do enjoy my time in Buenos Aires. I've got a few restaurants within a block or two or three that I like to eat at. They know me. I know them. I sit down with Char on the outside cafe, and they smile and give me a thumbs up. And I give them a thumbs up back. That means, hey, I want the same thing I eat every other time I come here.
Yeah.
And but it keeps me in the flow. It keeps me well grounded, and it just rebuilds my confidence. For example, you know, down in Argentina right now, I've got two lodges that I have represented exclusively for 15 years.
Mm.
And I'm next year, guarantee you, I'm going to venture out and go visit somebody else. But you know what? After 15 years of producing the experiences and the number of happy clients that those two lodges do, good luck trying to beat it. Now, I ain't saying it can't be done, but I ain't found one in 15 years yet that will.
Yeah.
And so I go by with my clients. I mix up with my clients and stuff, and we do a little hunt together. We get to know each other better. And then I'll go out and venture out and go look at somebody else and just fall into it. But I think that, you know, it's a grind being away from home that much. But at the same time, I don't know any other way to ensure quality control but to be there.
Sure.
But to be there and see it all. You know what I'm saying? I hear a lot of people say, well, I'm in this business and I've been on 100 different hunts. Well, yeah, I did that this year. We've got some friends that run an app called Hunt Proof. And I've never kept journals all these years, all these travels. I've never kept journals.
That's funny. I've got that on my list here. I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, I've never kept a journal, Brian. I've never kept a journal. In fact, in terms of personal harvest, I do know my species. I've got a book I write down the species and make notes and things of that nature in. Become a bird nerd, write them up. That goes back to that biology stuff. Since 1994, I've got just a little Right in the Rain survey book with columns in it that I've kept notes and retrieves since 1994 of the dogs I've owned. And every now and again, the closest I've ever come to like documenting my own personal harvest would be to go back, say, December 17th, I'm sitting there at camp and had a good day, had a bad day. And just for comparisons, I'll go back and see how many retrieves so-and-so had this time last year, this time the year before, this time. That's just kind of a barometer of how the dog's doing, you know, of how we're doing or how it compares. But I've always felt like, really and truly, if you let the numbers get into your head, I don't know. I just feel like it somehow cheapens it. You know, it's like, yeah, I almost don't want to know. I had some clients a few years ago hem me up. How many birds a year do you kill? I don't even want to know. Right. You know, and I don't want to know. It's not a numbers game to me. And anybody that's ever shared a duck blind with me will tell you, oh, the man shoots birds. He likes to pull the trigger. I'm not out there to watch the sunrise. I'm not out there. But I have evolved beyond just the trigger pull. I mean, if I leave a duck blind anywhere on God's earth with one duck or whatever, the state of Mississippi is a fine example, the limit's six. I can leave with one, I can leave with two, I can leave with four. It don't matter. It's duck hunting. You understand what I'm saying? I don't get back to camp and woe is me. I don't compare myself to the folks on the internet. I don't cry in my beer. I don't hate my life. I don't think less of myself or you or the dog or the day or the ducks. It don't weigh me down anymore. I'm not out there for that. I'm out there more for the experience, for the process. You know, that's what compels me about it. My son, oh man, it drives him crazy because after a flight or two of ducks, I'm that guy. I'm gonna get out and move one or two decoys or the whole spread. I don't want them to just dip in. I'll shoot them if they dip in. I want to own them. I want to own that duck, and I like playing that little bit of nuanced game with them. But I did get that hunt proof app this year, and the most telling thing that I won't tell everything I do, because that app will keep number of hunts, it'll geomark locations, it will attribute the species and the retrieves. But the one number that sticks out to me the most is, since, you know, I start my calendar year, the app starts July 1st, I keep up, I start my official year on Labor Day weekend with the open day of Mississippi dove season, and I run through August 31st the following year. But I have been on 191 hunts. Wow. And I still got a week in Netherlands and 2 weeks in Africa to go before September 1st. And attached to that, okay, so three of those days was down in Tasmania hunting Cape Barren geese. But it takes 6 days round trip to get to Tasmania and back. So that's 9 days away from home, not sleeping with my head on my own pillow. And that sometimes becomes a little bit of a grind.
I'm sure. So walk us through what's kind of similar to North American waterfowl hunting when you're traveling abroad, and maybe what are some super differences that you've seen?
Yeah. There is nobody culturally or a group of people that come close to the average American duck hunter. It's just not, you know, and it's more than you can approach it from our mindset of how we approach life in a very capitalistic environment, a highly successful, driven type environment. How that has affected the materials and the equipment that we hunt with. The decoys, the mojos, the pull strings, to getting down into that artistic part of it, to where we have mastered culturally as a country how to make the ducks present themselves. Because you know, if I'm in an environment that I'm going to have hundreds of ducks come through every single morning, so what if the wind's in my face a little bit? You know, so what if the sun's in my eyes for a little bit? I got enough opportunities, I can scratch out a limit. That ain't the way it is for most of us here in North America anymore. And I spend most of my days, most of those 190-something days were spent hunting in North America, Brian, and we've got to play that game. It's about getting that presentation. So if only 10 birds come through, they'll present themselves such that I'm in the opportunity to get my six. or if 12 or 13 or 15 birds come through, and that could be it on some mornings, you and I in a blind together, boom, can capitalize on that situation, right? And so I just wanted to start the conversation by saying, you know, I do believe that everything that me and you and anybody listening knows about duck hunting or thinks about duck hunting, it's based in America, and it stands as the gold standard. When you start getting further down the bushes, further out, it's almost like an emulation of it. You've got the decoys, because that's been around since forever. Boy, you better believe every country has or wants mojos. Because they work, yep. And I've seen all kinds of knockoffs, you know, homemades and all kinds of stuff. I would just say that the differences are trying to explain, going to some of my favorite places on earth and shooting a week and a half worth of consecutive Mississippi morning limits in a couple of hours, but then trying to explain to the staff that got us out there and did all this and did all that, and our host, trying to give them pointers of how to make the birds present themselves better. Mm. Isn't that absurd?
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy? they just their eyes glaze over. They don't understand it. You know, they point to the ducks. But you know, you were shooting tail feathers, or shooting them on the pass, or shooting them on the fly, shooting them coming in like a high house number one, instead of doing what we all want ducks to do.
Sure.
I'll say this too, the differences. A lot of times we do go to Safari Club International. I'm now the sub-chair of the Game Bird of the World program. I'd encourage anybody that collects anything in the world of birds to check us out. Because unlike a lot of the other prize or contest-driven formats, this is Safari Club International. We've got divisions throughout the world for waterfowl, for upland birds, but it's an organization that is committed to the future of hunting and to wildlife conservation. That's where the money's going, okay? Not in somebody's bottom line. It's going into conservation and hunting. And most years I get up and give a little seminar, and it starts like this, and it's the truth, just because you're asking about the similarities and the differences. When we think about hunting in North America, we think about decoys. But I'm going to tell you what, it's a world a whole lot bigger than my backyard, Brian. I have shot ducks in the morning and afternoon, at night. I've shot them by light. I've shot them over bait. I've shot them every which way that you can conceive, and right about the time I've pass shot them, I've shot them high, I've shot them low, I've shot them decoy, and I've chased them down in boats. I've shot them by moonlight. I've shot them on the oceans, the streams, the creeks, the rivers. I've shot them at 16,000 foot elevation in the mountains of Andes. You get what I'm saying? There's right. And right about the time you think you've seen and done it all in the world of duck hunting, you climb into a little piro in Azerbaijan, and they push pole you out a mile, you know, miles out into the blackness, and something else. Hmm. You know what I'm saying? It's unbelievable the approaches people have to killing ducks.
But fascinating.
Nothing is as personal or as visceral or as important as the game, I think, that we play, which right. is the conventional duck hunting way. I hear a lot of people say, well, that's pass shooting, that's no good. Man, pass shooting's amazing. A great pass shoot is one of the greatest and funnest sports there can be in the world of duck hunting. And a lot of people are surprised to learn that up in your neck of the woods, Pennsylvania, Minnesota, the Dakotas, at one point in time, especially in Minnesota and the Dakotas, man, there were fabled properties to this day that were known as duck passes. And for generations, members went out and stood the line and pass shot ducks.
For sure.
You know? So I try to be open-minded in my approach to doing things.
Right. That's a good way to be. Yeah, one thing I also wanted to ask you about, tradition's a pretty big part of your family lineage and history, as mine. Unfortunately, my grandfather's gone. I lost my dad to cancer 10 years ago. But I still got his Browning shotgun in the safe here. And I saw a video that you had a special shotgun that was passed down to you, and I'd like to hear that story. And I know my listeners would appreciate it if they haven't heard it before.
Yeah. I've, for 25 some odd years, I have shot Benelli shotguns. I love them for their, seriously, their utter reliability and simplicity. They've got me out of some real tight spots. If I'm gonna travel halfway across the world, you better believe there's gonna be a Super Black Eagle 3 packed. And I've got plenty of them. In fact, I came home from Argentina and spent a day and a half laying guns out on the table and cleaning and scrubbing and replacing and just getting them right again, right? And I grew up shooting, believe it or not, it's hard, man. You know, you realize, Brian, it's been 30 some odd years since we shot lead in America. I think 91, 92 that we made the conversion. 89, 90, somewhere in that time frame, we made the conversion over. And back in the day, I can remember I was down in Texas. I'd driven to a little hole-in-the-wall outdoor store in the middle of nowhere, not too far from the Mexican border, to go buy some ammo because I was going to go duck hunting. But walked right to the rack and picked up some 2 3/4 inch high brass lead fives, and the boy pointed that newfangled stuff called Steel Shot. And we didn't buy it because we didn't have to at the time. Next year we had to start shooting it, and at the time my entire shotgun lineup was mine, my dad's, my granddad's, and maybe my uncle's, and they were all 2 3/4 inch pumps or semi-automatic. You know what I'm saying? And the gun I had with me down there was an 870 Wingmaster, modified barrel. And I had grown up shooting a Remington 1100. And that Steel Shot really changed duck hunting and the way we think and the way we approach. And I think it changed as much for worse as it did maybe for good. And just in terms of mentalities, how the ammo manufacturers tried to overcompensate for the lightness of steel and the unperformance of steel. And I know it's come a long way since the good old days, since the bad old days of Steel Shot, but still. So anyway, back to your story. I just wanted to kind of lay out of what I shoot and how I grew up shooting. But my grandmother lived in a old Delta home that she had been born in. And the at some point in time in family history, it was a two-story house. They had raised the ceilings to about 14 foot, and the entire second story became like this massive attic. Think American Pickers type, epic proportion, built in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And one day I was up visiting her, and it was a big house. And she would, on a hot summer day, she would shut all the doors to all the rooms, and keep the air conditioning just in a couple of rooms, right. And so we were sitting there visiting, watching TV or something. And she said, oh, I found something I want you to have. And she came back a little later and handed me this long croaker sack. It was a canvas gun sleeve, dry rotted and everything else. And she had found an old Colt double barrel hammer gun up in her attic and handed it to me. Said, I want you to have this. I don't know whose it was. And that's, you know, I took it home and I went to a little gun store nearby, show it to him, get it looked at. And the first thing he told me was, son, don't ever, ever shoot this gun. Don't ever shoot this gun. It's too old. You do not want to, you know, it's got these black powder shotgun shell. You don't want to shoot it. It's chambered 2.5, not 2 3/4 inches. Just trust me. It's a Damascus barrels. They'll burst if you try to shoot conventional loads and everything else. So I was 15 years old. I'm 58 now. And for decades, I took it out and wiped it down with oil and pointed, looked down the barrels of it and wondered about it. Just I wondered about it, you know. And I think we figured out. I think we somehow just kind of did some figuring of who it must have been. And it probably my grandmother's granddaddy's on her mama's side. And my grandmother passed in the mid 80s or whatever, and they were cleaning out the house, and that Christmas my mother gave me this little drawing, a framed drawing. It was nice. And, I looked around, see if I was going to show it, hold it up and show it to you. And hang on just a second. I want to show you this drawing. See that?
Oh, yeah.
That's a little drawing my mother gave me for Christmas that year, and I looked at it, and I you can tell it's just a skiff with some duck hunters, and they're pointing, there's ducks in the back, and
right.
Somebody holding what appears to be a Springer Spaniel, which is odd for that date and era, but nonetheless, I looked at it, and I thanked her very much. I used to raise Springers on the other side of my family. They raised Springers since World War II, and I was a Springer fan. That's what I noticed first and foremost, but anyway, I thanked her. She said, "Well, honey, look at the initials on it. Look who did it." I looked at it, and S. McNeil. That didn't ring a bell. She said, "That's your great grandmother," which is my grandmother's mother, who was also born and raised in that house. Hmm. And she said, "You know what's so interesting is she used her maiden name." And we found that in a pile of drawings that with her maiden name on it, and the fact she did her maiden name. You know, she was probably 16, 17 years old, living in that little Delta home and just drawing in art class or whatever she was doing, like a lot of Southern belles of that era, probably just depicting her surroundings. She sure. said, you know, so it's not hard to imagine that whoever that is shooting that gun was probably holding that shotgun your grandmother gave you years ago.
Wow.
You know, I'm like, wow, I never thought of it that way, Brian. And as I look at that picture, it's just hanging right there in the den. I look at it often. As I look at that picture, that drawing, it's like my ancestors start to speak to me. Mm. My duck hunting roots started to speak to me from way back in the 1800s. And I did a little research, and, you know, they make black powder shells now. There are companies that specialize in this type of ammo for shooting these old guns like this one day. Right. And I reached out to a client that traded in those kind of guns, and he put me in touch with his gunsmith. His gunsmith said, "Hey, send me some stuff." I sent him some pictures, most especially of the barrels. He called me up and he said, "Son, don't shoot that gun. The bores are bad." like every other Damascus barrel made, he said there were 10,000 of those guns made and 9,900 of them have bad bores. And sure enough, there's a big rusty patch right in the middle of those bores from where black powder got left seated too long and began to corrode. And he said, besides that, those old Damascus barrels, you know, these modern pressures, it's like Brillo pad. It could be the first shot. It could be the thousandth. But at some point in time, you're going to pull the trigger. Okay. They're going to spread out. And I was real disappointed. He started talking about the collector value and everything else. I said, "But you don't understand. I don't care anything about the value. This gun, it has no monetary value. It's almost a spiritual value. Brian, I want to shoot this gun."
Absolutely.
And he bust out laughing. He said, "Well, that's easy." He said, "Send the gun down to Briley, get it bored out, put some 20-gauge sleeves in it, and go hunt with it, son, with these modern conventions." And so that's exactly what I did over the course of the next year. I took it to a local gunsmith I've known since high school. And one of the springs had gone bad. Couldn't buy it anywhere. He had to make them. Hmm. And then we sent it down to Briley after we got the action in working order. We sent it down to Briley. They bored out the 12-gauge, bored it out to where we could put those 20-gauge sleeves in it. I contacted Ball Shot Shells. They made me some 2 3/4-inch, super, super low recoil shells. I'm going to guess they fly 1,000 to 1,100 foot per second, because with wood that old, I was scared to death. I'd pull the trigger and the stock would splinter on me.
Yeah.
And I went out duck hunting with a friend of mine, Jim Cruz, that's got a really nice break to hunt up in North Mississippi. And I showed up, and I had a cameraman with me, Jake Latondras. We were going to film this passing of the torch, so to speak. And we were having drinks and eating lamb chops there at his cabin. And he said, "Ramsey, it's bad." He said, it's the worst duck season we've ever had. The ducks aren't down. I don't have any ducks." He said, "My fingers crossed we'll go out tomorrow morning. We'll shoot one duck." I said, "Jim, that's all I want to do is kill one duck." I want to kill one duck with this gun. But, you know, as compared to every shotgun I've ever shouldered, that old hammer gun has got it. The funniest, weirdest drop I've ever swung on. I mean, it feels like, you know, it just got a real weird drop.
Sure.
And as I was really sitting there against that cypress tree, hoping we'd see a duck to shoot at that morning, I was thinking, Lord, what if one duck comes in and I miss? And besides that, it's old hammer gun, these old rabbit ears, when do you even pull one back? When a duck, boy, let me tell you what, that old matter duck flew over right to crack of dawn, 5 minutes after legal. Whack, 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 we called to him. He hooked around a clump of cypress and lays up, coming right in. I knew just when to click it back. And then the first shot, he clapped his wings and died. And the duck guy, it's like I felt like my ancestors awakened the duck gods, because every duck in Cajoma County wanted to come into that duck hole that morning. And I couldn't miss with the old gun.
That's amazing.
And it really was. And then we took pictures. We had a great time. And I put the gun back up. You know, one thing, that old gun has got some green paint on the buttstock. And when I sent it to the gunsmith to get it reworked and make sure everything was in working order, he asked me, he said, don't you want me to go ahead and refinish these stocks? I said, no. He said, well, it's just that old green paint on there. I said, you know, that green paint could have been a barn. It could have been a duck boat. It could have been a duck blind. Don't dare take it off.
Yeah.
You know, so that's kind of how that came to be. And it was, and it does mean a lot to me. You know, every Christmas morning, now that the kids are too old for Santa Claus, they're grown people themselves, so everybody kind of sleeps and we do our thing. I get up before daylight. I drive an hour over to camp. There's not another living soul there. Sometimes one or both of my sons go, and it's culminated in the past 10 years in just kind of a, because you know, Christmas is a sentimental holiday. I mean, it's a family holiday of all holidays. And my gun of choice that morning is, I go back to that 1970s era Remington 1100, no vent rib. It was my grandfather's gun. He gave it to me when I was in high school. I assumed it'd be the only gun I'd ever own. And no, that ain't the way it worked out with steel shot and everything else. But every Christmas morning, I take it and I oil it and I get it ready to go, and I go out and I go shoot ducks with it. Mm. You know, and it ain't about the gun. It's about, I tell you, isn't it something crazy? It's millions of those guns made, but sitting in a blind with my family and that shotgun, it connects me in a way that nothing else can to some of the stuff that's real important.
Yeah, it's a special feeling for sure. I appreciate you going into the story on that. That's, I think I came across that on your YouTube channel. If anybody listening out there wants to see that video, it's pretty cool.
Thank you. Thank you.
So do you have, of all the places you've been, can you point to a place that maybe is a favorite or a couple of favorites, or is that too hard?
You know, I really, a lot of times I get asked that question. I like to say that my favorite hunt is the next one. Mm-hmm. And there is truth in that, absolute truth. I do love Argentina. It'd be hard to go spend 10 weeks away from home if I didn't love it. I love it. I love the fact that so much of their habitat, Brian, is like what I imagine the United States of America being 150 years ago. They sure do have row crop agriculture, but I would at least in parts of the provinces I hunt, I would liken it more to the 1960s and 70s in America than to present day industrial agriculture. Mm. There's an abundance of marsh. One of my favorite places on earth is from wherever I'm sitting, be it the floating houseboat to any duck blind we hunt within miles of there, as far as the human eye can see all the way to the horizon in all directions is marsh. Just undisturbed marsh. We're, at any given time, I'm no closer than 25 or 30 miles from a tire track, let alone pavement. Mm. And I find a lot of value. I just, that's what makes my heart beat. Because I know I'm hunting wild, naive ducks in a truly wild environment. I love Mexico. You know, it's a lot of my species. I'll be honest, I know you're a Pennsylvania guy. I know I got a lot of clients, a lot of friends, spend a lot of time hunting up north where it gets cold. I give me 70 degrees, 60, 70 degrees, sunshine, and still shoot a lot of ducks and have a good time. That's a little bit more to my liking. But in terms of the next hunt, we are always looking. And we do have those hunts. Always got hunts in the hopper. We're trying to develop and see what comes. A few years ago, it was South Africa, and that's online. We're looking at some other countries down in South America that have some real potential for true, unspoiled experiences. But believe it or not, here's the next hunt coming up. It won't be a Get Ducks commercial type hunt, but I'm very, very excited. I got approached by a follower, by a friend, by somebody that listens to the podcast over in the United Kingdom. And we went back and forth on the phone a few times and talked about some different stuff. And I'm really, as civilized as the UK is, I'm really excited to see that hunt. I mean, it's going to be in a lot of ways like stepping back in time. I'm going to be over there for 9 or 10 days in December. He wanted me to come in January. Impossible with my convention schedule. And so I carved out. He wanted me to come for 2 weeks. That ain't going to happen. That's just a reach. I don't know how I'm going to swing 9 days, but I will. And he's going to take me back in time. It's amazing to me that with the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, which was incepted in the early 1900s in North America because of commercial hunting, it's unique unto us. And thank Lord we have it because we still got an abundance of waterfowl. But in the United Kingdom, they can still hunt at night, not by light. So we timed this visit with a full moon. There's one species over there. It's one of the world species that very common species in Europe, called a pink-footed goose. And one of only two or three legal goose species worldwide I've not bagged, and we're gonna go hunt them at night. We're gonna make the club rounds, go to some of his little clubs, go to some of the bigger productions. I'm going to meet an older gentleman that still punt guns. We're gonna have a podcast, we're gonna have a conversation, and fingers crossed it all works out. There's a chance we're gonna go punt gunning. And I would like to do that. And I've told them, I've asked them, even if we can't orchestrate a full-on hunt, well, I tell you what, you read the history book, punt gunning sounds easy. Motor out to them, pull the trigger, kill a bunt. It ain't like that at all. Best I can understand it, it's a day or two or three laying in a punt, a two-man punt, so that I've got two poles. We're in a foot of water, and my arms are outside crawling like little long daddy legs. And hitters are doing the same thing. We're trying to steer and get ourselves within position to pull the trigger.
Sure.
But I hope to experience that. And I'm very excited for that. I'm very excited. You know, talk about the differences and the similarities to North America. I'm again, just for the experience, it's going to be great to have the opportunity to hunt pink-footed geese. But it's also going to be great to crawl back preceding North America into more our ancestry lineage and get to experience and do those kinds of things. So,
absolutely.
To your point, do I have a favorite place? Yeah, it's probably the next one. I love Argentina. I think that, you know, I heard an old timer say one time, there's two kinds of duck hunters, those that have been to Argentina and those that can wish they can come. And anybody shaking their head saying, well, I don't want to go. Yeah, you do. Yeah, you do. You want to crawl back and see what it was like to hunt pre-Migratory Bird Treaty Act back in the days when ducks were in such abundance. Anybody that likes a duck hunt would like to be in a raw, unspoiled environment with marsh as far as the human eye can see and an abundance of ducks like we've only imagined. Everybody wants to do that at least once.
Absolutely. Well, Ramsey, I've taken up a lot of your time. I sure appreciate you coming on. I've got some rapid fire questions for you to finish up.
Lay it on me.
Is there anything you wanted to cover before I moved on to that?
No, just to say thank y'all for listening. And anybody that would like to connect with me can go to @RamseyRussellGetDucks on Instagram, can go to Get Ducks on YouTube, or just type in getducks.com for all of the above. Ducks Eating Somewhere podcast, which, Brian, we talked before we interviewed. I do have a podcast, Ducks Eating Somewhere podcast, and believe you me, when I hang up, we're gonna schedule an appointment. I want to talk to you about some stuff myself.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. So let me hit you with these rapid fire questions here. What's your favorite waterfowl?
I'm gonna have to say Mallard's my favorite. They're found throughout the northern hemisphere. They decoy. Let's face it, everything that we think about ducks is predicated on mallard behavior. I love a mallard duck, and I like ducks that behave like mallards.
For sure. What's your favorite waterfowl recipe?
Good question. I like to take a fatty duck. It could be rosybill poached. It could be mallard. It can be good pintail and widgeon and greenwing till. The times will change as you do this, but it's a very, very simple recipe. It's what I call one of my pocket recipes. I pluck the breast and then breast it out. I want the breast pieces with the fat on. The thicker the fat, the better. Mm. And lightly seasoned. Put in a skillet, usually a cold cast iron skillet to start. Let that fat render down 3 or 4 minutes on this side. Once the fat gets browned up, roll it over 3 or 4 minutes. Take it out of that skillet, put it on a pan, put it in the oven for 3 or 4 minutes, depending on just how rare or medium rare you like it. And while that's going on, the skillet's still hot, I'll just take hard and fast recipe, something to the effect of butter, bourbon, jam. And that's the fun part. Love fig preserves, love peach preserves, raspberry works good. You start going around Europe or into other countries and you open up the cabinet, it's going to be an adventure on what you're going to make this little bit of savory, a little bit of sweet. Bring the meat out of the oven, drizzle it with that while it's resting, serve it.
Sounds good. What's your favorite snack in the blind?
Copenhagen.
Love it. If you had to choose, would you prefer to hunt lakes, marshes, or rivers?
Marshes, for sure, marshes.
How many decoys are you taking on an average hunt?
6 to 15. 6 to 15, and always a mojo, always motion, always a pull string. Always some form of water motion, but always, always, always mojo. You know, and sometimes the ducks will get it lures them from such a long distance, and I feel like the more opportunities I've got to seduce that duck into within killing range, the better. But there are times, you know, I don't just stick it out in the middle and hope for the best and stay the same. I'm willing to get out and move it. There are times, for example, late season Mississippi, there are times seeing that flash will attract ducks into the area so we can work them, but they're not going to set up and come into it after the sun comes up. And so in a situation like that, I might put it behind a tree, behind a bush to where it's obscured. Once they get set up and start falling in, they no longer see it, but as they're working high, they can see it. So I will move it around and play with it for a little bit.
For sure. Do you prefer to go in by boat, kayak, or walking in?
I guess I like to walk in, Brian. That's all the hunts I do worldwide. I do all of the above, P-Rows and boats and four-wheelers and everything else, But on the final little bit, if I can't boat quietly up to the blind, my preference is what we're talking about. I would like to walk in. Let me share a story with you. Imagine, a few years ago, I got to hunt Delta Marsh, kind of on the east side. And as we're sitting in the camp house looking down on Eaton Marsh, about a half mile, three quarters of a mile away, we can see the points we're going to hunt. And we walk down and there's no outboards. There's no mud motors. There's no long tail motors. There's a canoe with two paddles. Because since time immemorial, for as long as anybody can remember, that massive, massive Delta Marsh, which is right, that big wetland right below Lake Manitoba, for as long as anybody can remember, there'd been no motorized vehicle during duck season. And buddy, let me tell you what, I don't care how cold it was, you wasn't cold when you got to the duck blind in the morning. You were plenty warm after 45 minutes of boat paddling with all your gear and all your decoys and all your dog and your stands and everything else. And we'd have a conversation just like we're having right now. We'd be talking while we're paddling, huffing and puffing. But what astounded me was we'd round the corner and those canvasbacks and redheads or bluebills or whatever it was, mallards, they didn't fly. They just swam very serenely out of our way. And they just kind of parted ways, let us paddle through before they went back and did whatever they were doing. And I just realized that disturbance factor. I like the tranquility. I like, once you park the motor, stop the boat, stop the four-wheeler, some of my favorite times of the morning is when you're sitting in the pitch black dark, maybe a headlamp on so you can find something in your bag, but you're just sitting there getting suited up, putting the gun on your back, and you stop and you just listen, and it's total black and the stars are out, and you hear the ducks and you hear nature wake up. And you can't hear that racing through with all those loud motors and stuff. The ducks don't like it. I don't like it. I would rather just walk in quietly, get into place, and it be as quiet and invisible as humanly possible, and just be a part of nature as it wakes up.
Well said. The last question I always ask is your favorite place to waterfowl hunt, but I think we've covered that pretty well.
We've covered that. Yeah, we have. Brian, I hope to share a blind with you one day. I really do.
Absolutely.
I will say this. Last year, I did manage to scratch Pennsylvania from my list. I'm down to West Virginia and Virginia. And yep. It was tough. It wasn't easy. It took us 3 days. 2 days we didn't see a duck. And the third day we got into a cornfield. And right before the bell rang, one flock of matters come in and gave it up for us. And really, really, you know, we could have filled a pickup truck with Canada geese, but the goose season was closed. Yeah. Love to have it.
Well, good deal, Mr. Ramsey. I appreciate it. Anybody out there, make sure you check out getducks.com. Follow him on social. I really appreciate the way you present waterfowl hunting in such a great way on your socials, and really appreciate the time today.
Thank you, Brian, and thank you all for listening.
Huge thanks again to Ramsey for taking time out of his day to join me on the show. And thank you all so much for tuning in. I really appreciate it. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Migration Waterfowl. We also have a Facebook group for the podcast. Please join us there as well. And if you could, please check out our YouTube channel and subscribe while you are there. Lots of great content coming that way throughout the rest of the year. And join us every Monday for a bonus Migration Monday video podcast. You can find links to our merchandise store on our Facebook and Instagram pages. Check out our shirts, hoodies, thermoses, coffee, and more over there. And now through the end of September, 10% of everything we sell will go to Ducks Unlimited. If you like what you've heard here, please take a moment and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Send me a message or email after you leave the review, and I will mail you a Migration Waterfowl podcast decal. And get out there and enjoy the outdoors, but make sure you seek out a relationship with the one who created everything. Romans chapter 8, verses 1 and 2 says, "Therefore, there is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus, because through Christ Jesus, the law of the Spirit who gives life has set you free from the law of sin and death." And remember, the migration is coming. Be ready when it arrives. Tune in next week to hear another great guest on the Migration Waterfowl podcast.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.